Set. Well, welcome everybody to the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. This is February 16th, 2015. We've got four bills up this afternoon. We're going to take them a little bit out of order. I have a lot of people here from out of town on Senate Bill 534, so we'll take that up first. Then we'll take up Senate Bill 13, and we'll see what time we got left after that. So we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 534. James?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, Senate Bill 534 authorizes a city and an airport to enter an agreement pursuant to which the city provides sewer and water to the airport without requiring the annexation or consent to eventual annexation to the city, the territory where the airport is located, declares emergency effective on passage. There is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact and no amendments.
Senator Gerard, Senator Johnson, would you like to testify on this one?
Thank you, sir.
Welcome to the committee.
Colleagues, for the record, I'm Senator Fred Gerard. I represent District 9. It goes roughly from Shampooey Park to Mount Hood to the McKenzie Pass. Zigs and zags up, I have the better part of Clackamas, Marion, and Linn County. Colleagues, Senate Bill 534 is about as easy a bill as you can possibly get. It will be controversial, but it's a very simple bill. A city and an airport may enter into an agreement to which the city provides sewer and water services to the airport without requiring annexation. That's all this bill does. You will have opposition. Aurora seems to be kind of a hotbed, but this bill is statewide. You will see on OLIS a list of your airports. We have a huge number of airports. In my district alone, I have seven airports. And the problem with airports is they were usually placed outside the city limits. And by being outside the city limits, they relied on sewer systems that are becoming antiquated, and DEQ seems to be a restricting factor. I did tour the Aurora Airport, and there are certain things in my district that Aurora Airport is pivotal for. First of all, a life flight is centered out of Aurora. Second, Columbia Helicopters and Helicopter Transport, both huge helicopter companies. My district used to be called the Helicopter District. There's a reason it was called the Helicopter District. One is that we have a lot of Christmas trees that use a lot of helicopters. We have a lot of logging that uses a lot of helicopters. And there's a lot of agriculture that spray and use a lot of helicopters. So we deem that Aurora is critical. And again, this bill is for the state, but all the controversy we're going to hear today is from Aurora. So I just kind of preempted a little bit of it. First of all, on OLIS, you will see from Marion County Commissioners a unanimous vote in support of this bill, all three of them. Pass County Commissioner, who sits on the Aurora Airport Management Group, Patty Milne, sent a letter of endorsement. You will hear that Wilsonville is opposed to it, but you will see on OLIS that Wilsonville's Chamber of Commerce wants the bill. You will also see on OLIS, let me see, one other group I got here, Aurora Aviation Incorporated, Oregon Aviation Industries, they all support this bill. And the reason for it is our airports are decaying. And this is a very simple way of getting water and sewer to the airport. Now, you will hear some of the opposition say this is really an affront on EFU property. It is just the opposite. If you're able to take an airport and a city without annexing the whole thing in between, you're going to save a lot of EFU property. This is what this bill is designed to do. It also puts the city in the driver's seat because then they can negotiate. If they annex, they might be on the hook to put in all the improvements. This is favorable to the cities. And as far, the last I heard is the League of Oregon Cities is neutral on the bill. So that's pretty much all I have to say. I'd like to turn it over to my good colleague who has firsthand knowledge of Aurora, and this is where the hotbed of opposition sits. But once again, most of the opposition is from Clackamas County. This is in Marion County.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I have the privilege of being the state senator from District 16. I also have been in and around the aviation industry for 30 years. For 20 years, I was a working commercial helicopter pilot, owned and operated a company out of Scappoose. I also was the aeronautics administrator for 5 years for the state of Oregon, and so I actually managed Aurora Airport. There is more mythology surrounding the Aurora Airport than one can shake a stick at. The little thing is a tower is currently under construction at Aurora. I took the liberty of printing off a picture. I'm going to ask Senator Girard to make sure it gets entered into the record. There's now a control tower going up at Aurora. It was fought tooth and nail that it was suddenly going to make Aurora a landing strip for 747s, and FedEx was going to run in and out of Aurora. I've never heard so much hyperbolic hogwash in my life. That tower will be a boon to Charbonneau, a boon to Wilsonville, and a safety element at the airport long overdue. Aurora has a complex and interesting mix of aircraft that use it, from corporate jets down through people learning to fly, helicopters, airplanes. And so there was gloom and doom prognosticated when the tower was under construction. That tower is going to be an enormous safety benefit and will help elevate the entire aircraft system, or airport system. Aurora is owned by the state of Oregon. But again, as Senator Girard said, much of the controversy will focus around Aurora because Wilsonville and their lobby team have been just reflexively anti-airport for as long as I can remember, and I think in a very silly way. If you look at the south end of Aurora, where all the bright buildings are on the picture that I gave you, that is all largely private investment that has come to this airport. It is the home of Vans Aircraft, the largest kit-built airplane company in the world. And so the economic development that has happened at the south end of Aurora is really extraordinary. It also goes back to a very complicated issue with the FAA, and I'll spare you all the details of it, that has to do with through-the-fence operations. What through-the-fence means, quite simply, is it provides a mechanism for private capital to be put at risk at an airport and literally come through the perimeter fence to use the runway of the airport. But that's another story for another time. What we're really talking about here is how to service the companies that use these airports. At the north end of Aurora, as Senator Girard pointed out, is one of the largest and most well-respected helicopter companies, heavy lift helicopter companies in the world, with at one time close to 800 employees. On the south end, I don't know how many employees they have now, but this airport, as is reflected by the support that the Chambers of Commerce have given it, this airport is a key economic driver in this region. We had at one time collectively put extra money into Connect so we could help our system of airports throughout the state make the kind of improvements that they needed to make. With the money for Connect cut roughly in half and sort of an uncertain future as to what will happen to Connect, I think it's imperative for us to give these key economic drivers, airports, every tool in their toolbox to be able to create jobs, create safety improvements at the airport, and grow in orderly and organized ways. Extending sewer and water to Aurora is not an affront to farmland. Once upon a time, I was on the board of Thousand Friends, so I am sympathetic to the notion of farm and forest protection. But if you are told that somehow this bill is going to cause the loss of farm and forest land in a significant way, I categorically reject that notion. Instead, you're giving a legislative leg up to important economic resources in our cities scattered all throughout the state of Oregon, and you are putting one more tool in the toolbox for orderly airport growth. Thank you for your consideration of this important bill. And noted for the record, Girard and I agree on something, so that ought to give us extra style points. So.
Questions of the senators?
I love it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll let you get back to your business. Okay. Well, I'm just going to go down the list here then. Roger K., is it?
It is. That's correct.
Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee.
I appreciate you moving this bill up to the front. I'm sort of handicapped, so I have to leave early today, and that really gives me a head start on the other things I have to do. I submitted written testimony, and it's probably something that you've seen in your inbox already. My name is Roger Kay, and I represent Friends of Marion County, established in 1998 as a 501c3 farmland protection organization. Our mission is to protect farm and forest land parks and open space. I've also served on the Marion County Commission for the Planning Commission for two terms, and in 2010-2011, as president of Friends of Marion County, I was selected to serve on the Public Advisory Committee, comprised of airport users, representatives of local municipalities, and concerned citizens reviewing the 10-year Aurora Master Plan. And I've listed the seven chapters in that plan, just in case anyone is interested in taking a look at it. It's quite a thick, and it took us 2 years to get through it. This document was to be reviewed by the FAA Seattle Regional Office. However, the regional office is not familiar with Oregon's long history of farmland protections. Of course, our primary objective is to protect farmland in Marion County, and the Aurora Airport affects both Marion and Clackamas County since it lies near the border of the two jurisdictions and the city of Wilsonville, which is impacted by small aircraft traffic. So although, as Senator said earlier, the airport is contained entirely within Marion County, it affects Clackamas County and the city of Wilsonville, primarily those counties, that other county. As a matter of fact, during one of the meetings, there was a crash incident of a small aircraft into a private residence, and the homeowner appeared at the next PAC meeting to express concerns about the expansion of aircraft activity in that area. Our view from the outset was that the 10-year master plan would impact both farmland and regional transportation routes surrounding the airport, in particular high-value Class 1 soil farmland at the southern perimeter of the proposed runway expansion. In addition, safety concerns would require the closure and relocation of Kyle Road, a Marion County road heavily used as an agricultural transportation route. SB 534 proposes that Aurora Airport be permitted to establish an agreement between the airport and the city of Aurora to connect to the city for the purpose of supplying drinking water. I do recall that there is some data collected showing very low levels of arsenic in wells on Aurora Airport property. The results I've seen are quite variable and depend on the particular well sampled and the time of year. There are other private wells that supply drinking water to the numerous private property owners at the industrial air park area. Of course, there are ways to treat for arsenic and other contaminants in drinking water. These methods are readily available and should be adopted by the airport users if they have future or current concerns about drinkability. Passage of SB 534 is not the answer for the airport users. There are other impacts that arise from a proposed airport expansion. It is now time to realize that the Aurora Airport is constrained and that further land acquisition is not feasible and that extension of services beyond the UGB is a bad idea. Again, I want to emphasize our opposition and request that you vote no on this bill. If you have any questions, thank you so much for your time.
Questions? Thank you very much. Mayor Lehan, former mayor, I guess. Welcome.
Chair Beyer and members of the committee, I am the former mayor of Wilsonville, but current city councilor. And I just want to clarify a couple of things. You have my testimony, so I'm not going to read all of that. But I want to say that this is about Aurora, as it is almost every session has been since I was mayor. And it isn't really about the Aurora Airport. It's about industrial development and municipal development around in the areas around the airport. And that is our concern. I want to clarify that the city of Wilsonville never took any position to oppose the tower and generally has not opposed the airport. It is industrial development, whether connected to the airport or not, on French Prairie that is a concern. And we believe that this is contrary to Oregon land use law, and it's the sort of thing that has gotten us in trouble multiple times around the state, which is to say extending services to areas that have no municipal oversight or municipal standards, and then you have to pick up the pieces and try to fix it later. It's how you get places like Alloa and Clackamas and Oak Grove, East Portland, and the cities that eventually annex them struggle for decades, maybe forever, to pick up the standards and get them back to the to a reasonable municipal level. And that's exactly what happens when you let or encourage municipal development outside of the jurisdiction of a city. This is not something that is being pushed by any city. Aurora has not taken a position on it yet. It was not initiated by them and certainly not by the city of Wilsonville. It is an unnecessary piece of legislation because if Aurora wanted to annex the airport or wanted to provide service in anticipation of annexation, they could do it, and that's the way to there's a reason that land use is set up that way, so that if you're going to do municipal development, it eventually is going to come under the jurisdiction of a city and municipal standards. And I think that's where I will end and ask if you have any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Christina Sully, did I get that right?
Sully.
Sully.
I'm actually yielding my time.
Okay. Greg Taylor.
Thank you, gentlemen, for allowing me the opportunity and the privilege to speak before you today. My name is Gregory Max Taylor. I am a citizen of Aurora and resided there since 1970. In that tenure, I served on the Planning Commission, City Council, and I'm a former mayor. I do not speak on an official capacity for the city government of Aurora. I'm no longer in that tenure. However, as a citizen, I do have great concerns about this with regard to understanding the current infrastructure of the city. I know a great deal of this controversy has over land use around the airport. My concern is more with regard to the infrastructure of the city. We are not in any capacity, way, shape, or form to provide such services. We will not be in a while, a considerable while, 10 to 15 years. Financially, we couldn't do it. This bill leaves it too open and with language too vague to allow us the opportunity. It says we can negotiate, but negotiate usually ends up being a mandate, and it's not going to be done. Now, I understood, and even as mayor, growth is inevitable. We expect it. We understand it's going to happen. The annexation of the airport to the city of Aurora has the potential for some great benefits. We could, tax base alone would help us finance part of the infrastructure. But because of the way the situation of distance between the city limits and the airport, that is not a feasible concept at this time. And to put a burden on us, which we feel will happen, is not necessary right now. So as a citizen of Aurora, and I'm not sure what the general consensus is, but I can tell you now, as far as the citizens go, they will more likely be opposed to this in general and in whole. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you. Sir, I'm looking at it. This language is what we usually consider or call permissive, mm-hmm. which means that a city can if it wants to, but doesn't have to.
Yeah, and you and I have been in this game long enough. Note that's loophole language.
Well, I don't know. When I was on the city council, we knew what that meant.
And though it has that potential, that's dangerous language to put in some. If you want to do a land use deal, make it definite. Make it hard-lined and written down so everything can be specific.
You know, that's a different argument than I usually hear for cities. Usually they don't want us to tell them to do anything.
Well, we prefer that you didn't tell us to do anything, but define the parameters of what we can do. And like I say, what we can do usually becomes a mandate on us eventually. I believe this bill was designed with a singular agenda in mind, and this is the first bill in an action plan that's already taken place.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. And Mary Kyle, welcome. First time this session.
Thank you, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. Mary Kyle McCurdy, Policy Director at 1000 Friends of Oregon. You'll more often see me in front of you on transportation issues, but today I'm here to talk about Senate Bill 534. 1000 Friends is opposed to it. I'm not here to talk about the Aurora Airport in particular, but the general bill and the concept of where it fits or doesn't fit within land use laws, and you've definitely been hearing some issues about municipal law, but in general, Oregon's land use planning program is structured such that urban uses go on inside urban areas, and cities are the primary providers of those inside their boundaries, and rural uses go on outside urban growth boundaries, because urban infrastructure is expensive, it's a long-term investment, and it's meant to encourage more dense and efficient development. And they also, because of the level of investment in them, encourage development. That's right. And when those are in rural areas, it brings a lot of pressure on farmland, and it also causes conflicts with farm and forest lands. In this case, the Oregon Land Use Program does provide at least three ways in which a city can provide city services, water and or sewer, to a use outside the city if there is a need. And those three are that the airport requests an exception to what would otherwise be a farm or forest zone to run that urban service from the city to the airport or whatever the particular use is outside an urban growth boundary that would like or needs urban services. The second is a use can be added to the city's urban growth boundary and annexed. And the third is that DEQ can declare a health hazard that necessitates urban sewer or water service, and they have done that in the past. As we understand, in this case, none of those methods have been tried. And I can't answer why or why this bill is a fourth alternative, it appears, for that. But we support the land use planning program. It offers ways in which urban services can be provided outside urban growth boundaries when a need is shown. It seems like there's a lot of discussion still taking place at the local level, and so we don't support this bill going forward. It looks like a full discussion of these other possible ways is necessary at the local level. Thank you.
Questions? You know, Mary Kyle, normally, you know, I would agree with you on this, although I think airports are somewhat different without getting into the Aurora issue.
Right.
Airports you usually don't want inside urban areas for obvious safety reasons, so it gets to be problematic with that. Discussion we had the other day over the Eugene Airport, which originally was intentionally excluded from the UGB. Subsequently, they have brought it in as sort of a long stem annexation, but I'm a little bit perplexed by exactly how to do that, and I think the exception process is a little difficult.
Chair Beyer, I've been thinking about that conversation that we've had, and I think there's a little bit of mythology around the difficulty of the exceptions process, and the exceptions process is designed for when there is an urban need. You have to show that there is that need outside the, that there's a need for an urban kind of a use outside an urban growth boundary, and that it needs urban level of services. And then it can be conditioned also to ensure it doesn't impact, if it does run through resource lands, those resources. I'm certainly not familiar with all the rural airports in the state. I know we have a lot. I'm sure some are miles away from any city. And if they, if their development rises to a level where they need an urban level of sewer and water, there are also on-site ways in which that can happen. Here, this sounds also tied to industrial development going on around the airport. And I'm not here to talk about the Aurora Airport, but that does sound like...
But isn't that a different issue?
It might be, but...
That's really more of a planning, comprehensive plan issue on what things can you allow around an airport.
And I think that in this case, that's where the exceptions process requires that a need be shown for the exception itself, the airport. If instead this is being driven by the other development going on around it that could go on inside a city, then I think that's exactly the discussion that it sounds to me like the locals are having. But there's a way for an airport or any use that has to be located outside an urban area to get urban services if there is a need. This seems a little bit more enmeshed.
Okay. Thank you. Other? Thank you
thank
very
you.
Much. Ken Hector. Welcome to the committee.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I'm here to speak in support of Senate Bill 534. I am a resident of Silverton, and that's why...
And you need to identify yourself.
He's working on that.
In the interest of full disclosure, I am Ken Hector, but I work part-time for Representative Vic Gilliam. However, I'm here on my own time today speaking for myself alone and not on behalf of Representative Gilliam. By way of background, I've served on the Silverton City Council for over 25 years, 16 of those as mayor, and I'm still on the council. And once again, my remarks today are strictly mine, and I'm not speaking on either behalf of the city or the council, as they've not had an opportunity to review the bill. Silverton has had an on-again, off-again airport since the 1930s. It is no longer active and is privately owned as a landing strip. It is located just west of town, just outside our city limits. There are several adjacent businesses located appropriately on Airport Road and Aviation Way. One is served by city water, and all are on septic. In the mid-1990s, Silverton sought to annex the airport site to accommodate the growth needs of Blazer Industries, a manufacturer of modular buildings. When the effort was unsuccessful, Blazer sold their property and moved away with their business, and they had a significant number of employees. Had the city had the flexibility at the time to provide city services outside the city for economic development purposes, it's quite likely that Blazer would still be there today. As Senator Johnson mentioned, airports are a significant economic driver. And I, as Senator Girod mentioned, we're talking about a bill that has statewide impact. Although there's been a lot of mention in here today about Aurora, I think we need to not lose sight of the fact that this potentially impacts cities and airports around the state, which I think is a good thing. The beauty of this bill is that it, while it affords the opportunity for a city and an airport to enter an agreement by which the city provides water and sewer services to the airport without requiring annexation or without consent to eventual annexation. However, it does not provide any mandates, which is the nicest part of this bill. A city is free to choose to avail itself of the opportunity to enter the agreement or not. If it does choose to proceed, the city is well positioned to set the terms of the agreement under which it would provide the services, and I think that's very key. This is a true win-win bill, as both the city and the airport stand to realize economic benefit from the agreement. An additional benefit would be increased safety resulting from the use of city and water services over wells and septic, as well as reducing the environmental impact resulting from the depletion of groundwater. Again, this bill has no negative consequences. It mandates nothing, but it affords great opportunity for cities. I encourage your support of the bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions, Mr. Hector? Seeing none?
Thank you.
That is all I have signed up to testify on Senate Bill 534. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify today? Come on up. Welcome to the committee.
Hi there, Chair Farley and Senators. My name is Tony Helbling. I work with Wilson Construction Company. We're based up in Canby, Oregon. A little introduction about, and also I live in Silverton, Oregon, if that matters to anybody. Hey, Ken. So by way of introduction, I'm a commercial helicopter and airplane pilot. I'm a past commander of the medevac unit here in Salem. I'm the past president of an economic development nonprofit organization, and I'm a past planning commissioner, and I'm a city councilor. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the value of airports with respect to state operations, aviation type things. And key to that success for airports in our state as it relates to economic development is infrastructure, and so that airports can operate safely and successfully. With respect to emergency management, having spent time in the cockpit of a military aircraft doing life-saving operations here in the state of Oregon, if you remember the floods in 1996, I was the commander at that time. We saved 72 people, two dogs, and one cat. But we also kicked hay out the back of helicopters to out of the Chinooks to help farmers, and we picked that hay up at local airports here in the Willamette Valley that we could get to that were serviced through infrastructure. One of the things that we look at as emergency planners is not just can we fly in and out of the airport, but in the case of a large-scale event, which, God forbid, it hits this state, airports are traditionally identified by agencies such as the National Guard, such as FEMA, and other emergency assistance agencies where we can base those services. They're easy to get into, and they're a good collection area. One of the things that happens is emergency medical facilities, and in order to have those safely operated, we need water and we need sewer, or a sanitation system, plus a good road system around them. Shifting over to just general aviation as a fact, most of the airports that you're looking at that we're looking for these type connections between the municipalities and these outlying airports, these are served by general aviation. We're not talking airlines, and we're not talking UPS and FedEx coming into these airports. Most of these airports, if not all of them, are under 6,000 feet runway lengths. The largest aircraft that are going in and out of these airports really isn't going to change with respect to improving the airports for connections to sewer and water. One of the things that we need to look at when we make this decision is what this little piece of sand in this big beach adds up to in the long run. When corporate aviation decides to come to a location, they're going to look for an airport that is served safely but also efficiently, and that has to do with infrastructure, road access, sewer, water, telephone, electricity, fiber, optic internet. And the reason is they want to base their flight departments there. Now, take it a step back of what a flight department is. If you think about an airplane like a King Air or a Citation, those are about anywhere between a $2 and $5 million aircraft, carry about 6 to 8 people. Those aircraft are traditionally owned by companies that make between 100 and 200 million gross a year. And when you have a company that large, you bring in 50, 80, 100, 150, 200 jobs. And that means economic growth around an airport. And yes, you're going to have growth around an airport. That's not necessarily a bad thing. The other option is we could tear down half of State Street out front and take all the parking out. We could land the airplanes there because it's inside a growth boundary. But that doesn't make a lot of sense to do that. If we're going to improve and invest, let's do it where it makes sense, where we as pilots can fly neighborly around folks to try to keep our noise signatures to the least and also fly safely. Also involved in general aviation is hobby aviation. I do it myself. I also am a boater, and the state provides me with areas that I can boat, public boat ramps. All we're asking is that you consider allowing municipalities to invest in the airports so that hobby aviation can participate. Along with that is flight training. This is conducted at airports all around the state. If we have airports that aren't served by infrastructure, they don't get used. If they don't get used, they'll deteriorate. And you have major flight training operations, both for local students but also worldwide students in this state. And it just seems like a very unimportant thing to that flight training, but to have the infrastructure available at those airports where a business can operate and pump fuel, that attracts those flight students to fly from Hillsboro or from Troutdale or from Eugene to participate at that airport. And that, again, brings money in. I won't argue with anybody that says, hey, you know, we don't want to build something that's going to make noise or something that's unsafe. Because I'll tell you, everybody in my business, in the aviation business, is just hell-bent for safety. At the same time, we want to fly neighborly and respectfully of those around us. I guess close it out, I'd like to just offer myself up for any questions or comments either here or after the session or the testimony. Feel free to give me a call, and I left my contact information there.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much.
You bet.
Appreciate you coming. Again, anybody else wishes to testify on this bill? Going once? Twice? Okay, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 534, and we will open a... Let's see, I'm going to go up here. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 13. James.
Mr. Chair? Senate Bill 13 authorizes law enforcement agencies to establish sobriety checkpoints, defines sobriety checkpoint as a roadblock for apprehending persons driving under the influence of intoxicants in violation of ORS 813010, takes effect only if Senate Joint Resolution 3 is approved by people at next regular general election, become effective on date of constitutional amendment proposed in Senate Joint Resolution 3, and takes effect. There is no revenue impact, and we are still waiting the fiscal, and there is no amendment.
Thank you, James. Senator.
Yes, sir. I am Senator Rod Monroe, District 24. I happen to be the author of the state's drunk driving law, which passed back in 1983. I also served 20 years on the governor's advisory committee on DUI, having been appointed by Vic Attia. And I've been involved in issues related to traffic safety and drunk driving all my career. Did you get copies of my testimony? She's getting that to you. Senate Bill 13 are the guidelines, according to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, on the use of sobriety checkpoints. Senate Bill 13 will only go into effect if SJR 3 is passed by the voters of Oregon. SJR 3 will ask the voters to allow law enforcement to use sobriety checkpoints permissive to evaluate drivers for signs of alcohol or drug impairment. Checkpoints are publicized in advance and signs are posted warning drivers that a checkpoint is ahead. Sobriety checkpoints are a deterrent to driving impaired. The cars are pulled over in a special sequence, and maybe every third or fourth car would be inspected. If the voters approve SJR 3, enforcement agencies will have the discretion to use sobriety checkpoints. Again, permissive, not mandatory. 38 states use sobriety checkpoints and have seen a reduction in highway fatalities and serious injuries. Fewer trips to the ER would save Oregonians millions of dollars in health care costs. These checkpoints only delay motorists for 2 or 3 minutes. And I'd like to add that I spent a night on a sobriety checkpoint in the early 80s, and it was an average of 2 minutes that these motorists were stopped. I asked them whether or not they resented being stopped for 2 minutes, And universally, they said, if it makes our streets and highways safer, I'm for it. The primary advantage of sobriety checkpoints is as a deterrent. It's not to arrest a bunch of people. When motorists think they may be stopped by a sobriety checkpoint, they are much less likely to drive impaired. Sobriety checkpoints were conducted in Oregon prior to 1986. A woman in Eugene was stopped at a sobriety checkpoint in 1982. She sued and lost her case in the Lane County Circuit Court. She appealed to the Oregon Court of Appeals, and they reversed the circuit court decision. A year later, the Oregon Supreme Court upheld the Court of Appeals decision. The reason given was that Oregon did not have the standards of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration guidelines in place. Senate Bill 13 will establish those standards. Since 1986, law enforcement agencies have not been allowed to conduct sobriety checkpoints in Oregon. Sobriety checkpoints are an important tool to keep our streets safe from dangerous, impaired drivers. This is even more crucial today with the passage of recreational marijuana last November. Drunk driving is an all-time low, but drugged driving is significantly up. Impaired drivers are often using a combination of marijuana and alcohol. With the passage of Measure 91, this combination will likely increase even more. The primary goal of sobriety checkpoints is not to arrest people, but to deter people from committing DUI. Recent polling shows that about 65% of Oregon voters approve reinstating sobriety checkpoints. And that poll was done just last year. There were 1,000 people tested, so it's a major poll. So it will happen. These checkpoints will only be reinstated with a positive popular vote. Voters are going to get to vote on it. I would urge your support of this measure.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions of our colleague? Guess not.
Thank you.
All right, so we've got about five people signed up. Eileen Smith, I'm just going to go down the list. Welcome.
Eileen Smith, Marion County. I see this as unconstitutional if the what we have is a warrantless check. There, it makes every single driver, you're the fourth driver, every single fourth driver is guilty until proven innocent. This is a constitutional change. It's not put into place as the gentleman has written.
Just to be clear, this bill, if we pass, this is not a constitutional change. As the senator said, it would require a constitutional change by the citizens of Oregon before it become effective. Not arguing for or against, just wanted to clarify that.
Okay, but you're setting up for a constitutional change. It's going to require a constitutional change. Your bill is going to require that. So therefore, if there is a reason to require a constitutional change, it is an unconstitutional proposal. Okay. It is a warrantless, I'm seeing multiple research. I've looked for this multiple research. It's not cited in anyone's references to this multiple research. I've looked at the research. There's no proof. I'm an evidence-based person. I'm sorry. I'm looking for proof that it saves lives. It saves injury. I'm not seeing that. I'm seeing someone saying that, but I'm not seeing that in the evidence. I think this is a slippery slope. It is, again, unconstitutional. You all have taken oaths of office. If you'd like, I can read them back to you right now, because I do have them up, saying that you will support and abide by the Constitution. It's also in your public law for code of ethics. So please, as much as I want to prevent drunk drivers on the road, and warrantless checklist is not the way. Have them, you're going to bring all your state patrol guys, county guys, everybody's going to all get together while there's other people taking the side roads, because they know just where they are and they're going to be drunk. That's where your drunks are going to be. They're not going to be at the checkpoint. Common sense, please. I'm sorry. I don't agree.
Thank you very much. Questions?
Thank you.
Don't see any. Thank you. Let's see. Kate Duke. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me the time to speak with you today. My name is Kate Duke. I am a member of the board of Madeline County Chapter. I'm here today to speak in support of Senate Bill 13. Part of MAD's mission is to end drunk driving and fight drugged driving. To this end, MAD strongly supports sobriety checkpoints. They are one more tool to help achieve their vision of no more victims. Sobriety checkpoints have been studied extensively and have been shown to be effective. CDC cites a review of 11 high-quality studies. They found sobriety checkpoints resulted in a reduction of alcohol-related crashes by about 20%. While law enforcement may actually apprehend impaired drivers at the site of these checkpoints, the biggest impact is the deterrent effect that they have. Since they are announced ahead of time, people are aware that they may be stopped. So rather than risk driving impaired, they take that opportunity to have a designated driver, set cash aside for a cab, take a bus, any other means that means that they're not driving impaired. Checkpoints really result in lives saved. They also prevent the economic costs to society that are associated with impaired driving crashes. According to MAD, the annual cost of alcohol-related crashes to society is over $132 billion. With the passage of our recreational marijuana law, it may be more important now than ever for us to join the other 38 states that use this tool. In addition to MAD, Senate Bill 13 is also supported by the Oregon District Attorneys Association, the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance, Crime Victims United, and the Governor's Advisory Committee. Please support this bill and allow the citizens of Oregon the opportunity to vote on this important topic. Thank you for allowing me the time to speak with you today.
Thank you. Any questions? No, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Gail Meyer. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. As a preface to my comments, I just want to assure the committee, OCDLA does, we do represent the people who do get arrested for impaired driving, but we also are users of the public roadways of this state, and we do have loved ones, including ourselves, that are out there. So we definitely do endorse the notion and the understanding and the expectation that people should be able to drive safely on the roads of the state of Oregon, and I wouldn't want my comments to be understood to say anything other than that. But we do part company with the proponents of this bill as to whether or not it's necessary or whether or not it's even well advised to amend our Constitution in order to obtain safe streets. Oregon's Constitution, our search and seizure clause, is protected in Article 1, Section 9, and it's given a very, very robust interpretation that is independent of that of the Fourth Amendment, which is the federal constitution. Article 1, Section 9 has not been amended since statehood. And in contrast with the federal Fourth Amendment, the Fourth Amendment has been described as protecting an expectation of privacy, a reasonable expectation of privacy. As you might imagine, the more that government encroaches upon your privacy, you have less and less of an expectation of privacy. So think of the NSA surveillances and whatnot that's come out. The more and more government is invading into the privacy realm of the individual or of the citizens, the lesser and lesser your expectation becomes. In contrast to that, Article 1, Section 9 establishes a guarantee. It establishes a right. It's a floor. And it doesn't depend on your expectations, and it doesn't depend on whether or not they're reasonable. It's a right. What SJR 3 and the corresponding bill, Senate Bill 13, would do would be to change that, at least as it relates to sobriety checkpoints. And so the question that we pose ourselves and we would pass on to you is whether or not that's necessary to obtain safe roads and as to whether or not that would be well advised. As to whether or not it's necessary, it's my understanding that there's going to be witnesses coming in behind me who will talk about the research as to whether or not sobriety road checks really are a superior way of interrupting impaired driving over saturation patrols. Saturation patrols are when you just have a coordinated mass of officers out there on the streets doing interdiction of drunk driving in a coordinated but random fashion in a particular area. It's my understanding that the research would show that random patrols are just as effective and, if not in some respects, more effective than a roadblock. But what I'd like to pass on to the committee is a few problems we would see if these measures were passed. The first question would be, really, what would sobriety road checks look like in Oregon? And you really can't take too much assurances by this publication. So the Senate Bill 13 incorporates by reference this publication. And I didn't bring my glasses. Oh, I did bring my. Okay. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration publication entitled The Use of Sobriety Checkpoints for Impaired Driving Enforcement. Senate Bill 13 incorporates this by reference, but this doesn't have prescriptions that are mandated. This simply sets guidelines. And so it's aspirational, but it doesn't give you clarity as to what any one agency will do. It suggests that every single agency who implements a roadblock needs to have procedures and protocols in place, but it doesn't itemize with particularity what those procedures must be. And so the questions posed is, what will the road check look like? Is it really just simply a 15, 20 second, have you had anything to drink tonight, taking any controlled substances? Thank you, be on your way. Or is it more invasive than that? And this publication doesn't really mandate or tell an agency what they should or should not do during the course of that stop. These stops will occur at night. Officers will tell you that for officer safety, they will need to take their flashlight and put it back and through into the interior of the vehicle. They'll want to look at the floorboards. They'll want to see what's around. They'll be looking for weapons. They'll be looking for contraband. They'll be looking for anything that gives them a sense that they're safe before they first engage in any query with the driver. In the course of that, then, what of that? And so the publication here states that there should be policies in place, but what of those policies? They should be observant for the interior of the vehicle, for not only containers for alcohol and paraphernalia, but for other contraband such as weapons, searches of the vehicle and the interior of the car, searches of the driver, searches of the passengers shall be conducted only when consistent with department policies or when legally permissible. Legally permissible has a broad range. It could be consent. Ma'am, do you mind if I take a look inside your car? It could be they see something that they think might be contraband or curious, and then they would ask everyone to come out. So the point we'd like to raise is we really don't know, by reference to this document, what a roadblock will look like as it's actually implemented. And it could be that different police agencies will implement them differently, and then you'll have inconsistencies about that throughout the state. And the other thing that we're concerned about, and it's a legal one, is what law will apply once the stop occurs. So if you were to look at SJI 13, you've got your prescription in Article 1, Section 9, and then it would read, this section does not prohibit the use of sobriety checkpoints by law enforcement officers. Is it saying that the stop is permissible, or is it saying everything occurs arising from the stop is permissible? And that actually is a very difficult question to answer. I don't know the answer by reading this. It could be that there's just a carve-out under Article 1, Section 9 for the initial stop, but the Article 1, Section 9 applies to all the procedures that occur from the stop thereafter, or it could be there's a carve-out for Article 1, Section 9 for everything that flows from it. I'd submit to the committee that that actually is a pretty delicate constitutional issue. I think the appellate courts would take a long time to figure it out. And we think that there would be a lot of inconsistent application of this that would result in a lot of heavy appellate litigation flowing there from it. So we would encourage the committee to wrestle with these issues. Happy to answer any questions we can along the way. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? See none. Thank you very much. Good.
Thank you.
All righty. Paul Steigledger. I probably just did that terrible. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Beyer and members of the community. I am Paul Steigledger, and I'm a retired law enforcement officer in the state of Oregon here, in one of the counties. Did 28 and a half years as a law enforcement officer, and the majority of that time I was a drug recognition expert and a drug recognition expert trainer and a DUII hunter, DUI, horizontal gaze, nystagmus, field sobriety test at all, as far as instructing other officers how to look for and test drugged or drunk drivers in the state. Native Oregonian, born and raised here, fifth generation. And the reason I'm here today is to talk to you about how can we as a state continue to get the best bang for the buck as far as enforcement of drugged and drunk driving enforcement. Are sobriety checkpoints the be-all to end-all? Are they the answer that we're all looking for? They're not, unfortunately. I'm here in Salem currently as a citizen legislature and watching the implementation of Measure 91 for a national organization against prohibition. I'm not here today testifying on behalf of that organization. I'm just here to talk about, are we doing the right thing by looking at introducing Senate Joint Resolution Number 3 to the voters? I can't find anything, even currently, that talks about how sobriety checkpoints are the best use of our money. Oregon is in company with 13 different states that has never implemented sobriety checkpoints since the Supreme Court decision came out and said that they're legal. So none of these other 13 states have gotten to where they're asking this question. Should we implement sobriety checkpoints? It's not the case. Three of the 38 currently are looking at repealing sobriety checkpoints. Saturation patrols, in my opinion, are the most effective way of curbing drunk driving and drug driving. I used to run them all the time, and we would get media blitzes out there, we'd get reporters that would ride along with us, and we'd show the people how we made stops, how we made traffic stops for testing and detecting drugged drivers. So we got the fear of arrest out there by publicity. And then what we would do is we would spread that fear of arrest over a large geographical area. We would incorporate the small cities, the counties, and the state police to go out there and look for drunken and drugged drivers. that was an effective tool. I was able to get grants for those specific types of enforcement activities, and I was able to show a corresponding decrease in the number of fatality crashes and serious injury crashes that are alcohol involved. I mentioned earlier that I'm a long resident, lifetime resident of Oregon. And our Constitution is such that it doesn't currently allow for sobriety checkpoints. And I don't think that we need to go and amend the Constitution just to try and implement something that may or may not work. There's going to be maybe a handful of agencies that can run checkpoints in the state. They're labor intensive. Even if you have five officers, you have to have a platoon of volunteers to go out there and to set up a sobriety checkpoint. If you look at your technology devices and Google DUI saturation, or I mean sobriety checkpoints, they'll come up with at least five or six different folks that will tell you exactly where the sobriety checkpoints are. So the sobriety checkpoint goes away. It reduces its effectiveness. They talk about five officers conducting a sobriety checkpoint. That could take up a whole county in some of the counties. And then there's no ancillary officers out there looking for people that avoid the checkpoint. So people know where it's at. They completely avoid it. You're not getting the people that should be arrested because they're driving intoxicated, and they've done this for so many years. We are right on par, if not better, than most of the states in the United States as far as our fatality rates. You look at the fatal accident reporting system, we're doing a good job here in Oregon doing the things we're doing. There's a finite pool of resources. The Traffic Safety Commission can let grants to do different sorts of enforcement activities. And I'm saying that because we have that finite resource, we need to get the best bang for our buck. And the best bang for our buck are saturation patrols over sobriety checkpoints. Publicity and saturation patrols are going to be able to continue to affect the fatality and serious injury traffic crashes in Oregon without making a constitutional amendment. Oregon's prided itself on our Constitution, and I would recommend that Senate Joint Resolution Number 3 not go forward to the voters, and then that would make Senate Bill 13 moot. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dave Fandenke. Welcome, Dave. Getting a couple
Thank
last
you,
ones
Mr.
in
Chair.
Before retirement?
About a month and a half, yes, Mr. Chair. For the record, David Fandenke, Executive Director of the ACLU of Oregon, testifying in opposition to Senate Bill 13 today. You've heard a couple of references to the Oregon Supreme Court decision that ruled that sobriety checkpoints were unconstitutional under the Oregon Search and Seizure Clause. That case was an ACLU case. The plaintiff in that case, Linda Nelson, called me on the phone the day after the first sobriety checkpoints were set up in Lane County. And we readily agreed to represent her. She was stopped in a sobriety checkpoint, was required to go through some field sobriety tests, and was not arrested because she was sober. But she was quite upset by the experience, not because of what happened in the course of the checkpoint itself, but because just a few minutes prior to being stopped in that checkpoint along Marcola Road, I believe that's in your district, Senator. She had been driving east on Highway I-105, which then becomes 126 as you cross over I-5, going into Springfield, and pulling onto Highway 126 in front of her was a car that was weaving all over the road. That driver was almost certainly drunk. But instead of there being police officers looking for signs of drunk driving on Highway 126 that evening, every officer that was on duty was staffing the sobriety checkpoint on Marcola Road, which she ended up in just a few seconds later after she got off the freeway at the 42nd Street exit in Springfield. She felt in her gut that it was wrong for hundreds of innocent people to be stopped and questioned about their alcohol use and having to prove their innocence rather than having officers out looking for the signs, the visible signs of drunk drivers. We believe she was correct in that gut feeling. The Oregon Supreme Court, it should be noted, in the Nelson case, when this decision came down in 1987, was divided about whether sobriety checkpoints would always be unconstitutional. The plurality of justices in that case actually found that a sobriety checkpoint could be constitutional as long as the purpose was to get drunk drivers off the road and not to arrest them. Now think about that. If the officers that night had had some taxicabs ready to drive people home, they could have suspended the driver's licenses of anyone who was stopped in that checkpoint and cited or arrest or would have been otherwise arrested for driving under the influence. They just couldn't charge him with a crime. But of course, all of us here today want drunk drivers to be arrested and charged with the crime of driving under the influence. The statistics are clear that saturation patrols are more effective at arresting drunk drivers than sobriety checkpoints. The argument in favor of sobriety checkpoints is that the proof of their effectiveness is the small number of people who are arrested for driving under the influence. I would submit to you that that is counterintuitive for a good reason. What is effective about, in terms of deterrence, about saturation patrols as well as sobriety checkpoints is the publicity in advance. Saturation patrols are more effective because people don't necessarily know where the officers are going to be. They know there are going to be more officers out looking for the signs of drunk driving, but they don't know where they're going to be. Now, Google may be changing that, too. But we've done a lot of other things in this state since 1987 to deter people from driving under the influence. And those things have been effective. I was looking at the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration website over the weekend and found a chart which showed the three-year rolling average of alcohol-impaired driving fatalities. In the years 1995 through 1997, Oregon had an average of 167 alcohol-impaired fatalities over that three-year period. In 2011 through 2013, that number had dropped to 96. Now, we've done a lot of things over that period of time. We have lowered the implied consent amount from 0.1 to 0.08. We've greatly expanded the use of ignition interlock devices and many other things. Those other things are all being effective. I would argue to you all today that we do not need to amend the Constitution, which I think in most of the time, especially when an amendment would weaken a core provision of the Oregon Bill of Rights, that's a bad idea. And in this case, it's clearly a bad idea with apologies to Senator Monroe. I know he feels very strongly about this issue, and I appreciate his commitment to ending drunk driving and all that he has done over the years. But I urge this committee to oppose this legislation. Thank you, unless there are questions.
Questions.
Thank you.
That is all I have signed up to testify on Senate Bill 13. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify? Please come forward. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I am not an attorney. I am not a police officer, and I am not very experienced at this. So I teach school. My name is Wendy Coombs. I live here in Salem.
Okay.
So I'm really pretty glad that this is happening today when I don't have to be working. Thank you. I recently heard about this bill, and I have some concerns about it. The first thing that popped into my mind was the Constitution of the United States, the Oregon Constitution. And while this doesn't address or can't take place without the Constitution being changed, passing it seems to be stepping outside and setting rules up that don't follow the Constitution, and that doesn't seem right. It also isn't, the constitutional changes at this point aren't being initiated by the people. It's a government initiated change. I've learned some things while being here. I didn't know that saturation patrols were called saturation patrols, but while I was thinking about how this would play out, and I read the use of sobriety checkpoints for impaired driving enforcement that has been referenced in this bill, which if it were passed, it would be making this law as well, it seems to me. It talks about signs or devices being placed to provide advanced warning about why motorists are going to be stopped. If I just left the bar and I saw one of those signs, that's not where I'd be heading. I wouldn't be driving down that road. I'd go somewhere else. It also says a motorist who wishes to avoid the checkpoint by legally turning before entering the checkpoint should be allowed to do so unless there's a traffic violation or other probable cause. The act of avoiding a sobriety checkpoint does not constitute grounds for a stop. So again, if I have reason to question my sobriety and I see one of those signs, I'm going to turn around and go. And by what this says, I can't be chased or whatever, because unless I do something wrong in the process. And as was mentioned before, if somebody is stopped and the officer is checking, he's or she is checking for all kinds of things that could be an issue. It's not just, as far at least as I read this, for drunk or being inebriated at that time. It seems like there was something else I wanted to say. It seems to me that it would be, as has been said, isolating the limited number of officers, removing them from the ability to be helping the rest of the public as need arises to be in one place. And if I'm waiting, according to what this said, the highway paper thing, they are recommending that every person be stopped. Or if that doesn't work, then maybe every 1 in 5, 1 in 10, not 1 in 3 or 4. So the odds of catching or by the luck of the draw, somebody being picked up are not as good as an officer that's out and about looking for and recognizing, because they've been trained, the signs of somebody who is driving impaired. I have concerns about good intentions being supported in a way that could turn and cause unintended or unforeseen problems in the future. And I don't know, Ben Franklin made the comment to give up a little bit of freedom for safety. Those who surrender freedom for security will not have, nor do they deserve, either one. And so I would strongly encourage that this not pass. And thank you for your time. Sorry for the nerves.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
No, you did a good job.
Well, thank you.
Good job. Very good. Okay. Again, is there anybody else who wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 13. And we will open the public hearing on, I think it's 17, mm-hmm. on Senate Bill 17. James.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 17 creates Oregon Intellectual Property Protection Corporation to protect businesses' intellectual property rights, promote research and development of new technologies, and manage the corporation's funds and assets. Specifies corporation as a government entity that performs governmental functions and exercises governmental powers, but is not a municipality, local government, or state agency. Directs governor to appoint board of five directors for terms of 4 years, subject to Senate confirmation, establishes the Oregon Intellectual Property Fund, and enables board to invest monies from fund for continuing purposes of corporation, requires Secretary of State to conduct annual audit of corporation and fund, and issue report to governor, president of Senate, and speaker of House. We have no revenue or fiscal impacts issued, and there are no amendments.
Thank you, James. Sam Pardue, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. My name is Sam Pardue. I'm the CEO and founder of a startup manufacturing company based in Portland, Oregon called Indo. I moved out to Portland about 18 years ago to work for Intel Corporation after getting my MBA at Carnegie Mellon. Lasted there a few years before I became a startup CEO and but before all of that, I worked at Los Alamos National Laboratory in a nuclear weapons think tank, and we studied arms control and nuclear weapons proliferation issues and nuclear weapons deterrence. And so some of that thinking has influenced this idea that's presented here before you, which is really, admittedly, it's kind of very creative. It's out of the box. This is a big idea that maybe hasn't been tried before, but it could be very interesting if we could craft the right legislation around it. But Senator Shields. So the idea here is that when you're a startup company and you develop intellectual property assets, as Indo has done, so Indo has filed a patent, received a patent for our unique compression tubing, which is a very simple mechanism that makes our product work. But as a startup, you have a couple major hurdles around your intellectual property. The first is that investors won't value the intellectual property portfolio that they have when you're out soliciting capital from venture capitalists or angel investors, because these investors don't believe that you can credibly defend your intellectual property. They don't think you'll have enough money in the bank to go prosecute someone if they violate your patent. So that's one problem. It blocks you in terms of your capital accumulation abilities. Secondly, that is kind of the reality. When you're a startup, you have very limited resources, and there's a real risk that if someone does violate your intellectual property, you won't be able to actually go after them for it during those early stages. And so the idea here that's encapsulated in this legislation is to try and create a mechanism by which the state could defend early stage startups and give them a kind of a badge that would basically allow deterrence of potential violations of your intellectual property. For deterrence to happen, you have to have three things. One is you have to have a credible ability to retaliate. You have to have the ability to bring a lawsuit against the violator of your patent. So you have to have the credible resolve to take action, like people believe that you'll retaliate against them. And third, you need to be able to publicly signal so that the person that's violating your or thinking about violating your intellectual property is deterred from doing it in the first place. Those are the three things that really need to be in place in order for deterrence to occur. Used to happen with the nuclear weapons in the United States and Russia. You know, the United States and Russia would signal, well, if you launch missiles at me, I will send them back at you. It's called mutually assured destruction, and it worked. We haven't had any big incidents. So it is to take that kind of thinking and embed it in a law or a mechanism. I don't think we're certain that, anyway, so that startup companies would get this badge of defense that would allow us to deter violations. Indo actually had its intellectual property violated, and it was really a very troubling chapter in the history of our company. It was a company called QuantaPanel out in Connecticut. Fortunately, there was a third party involved in our dispute because the QuantaPanel did not believe that we were going to prosecute our patent against them. But there was a third party, a real estate developer, that did. And they were less sophisticated about patent law than QuantaPanel was. But it was one of those things that scared me to death. It happened this past fall. We managed to get through it. But I know that if we had had maybe a little blue badge on our website that said, you know, protected by the, you know, Oregon Intellectual Property Defense Fund or corporation or however it ends up getting structured, it would have been a very credible threat that we would be able to retaliate, and it would have been very public. And that would be the idea here, is to give startup companies kind of a mangrove swamp, if you will, where they can grow up before they have to swim with the sharks out in the ocean. So I think we've got some ideas here about how it could be structured. There's definitely, you know, need to be a lot of thought and care about how this would eventually be set up to make sure there weren't unintended consequences. But it would be the kind of thing that if we could actually pull it off, might get national headlines and signal to entrepreneurs around the United States that Oregon is a very startup-friendly place that's doing innovative things to make business here happen in new and exciting ways. So with that, I'll conclude my remarks unless you guys have any other questions.
Any questions at all? Can you stick around just for a second? Let's go to Senator Shields.
Thank you, Vice Chair Gerard, Chair Beyer, for hearing this bill. Sam brought this bill to me, idea about 4 years ago, and it took me a little while to get my arms around it. But I think the premise that I like about it is that if we believe that the Attorney General is the people's lawyer and not just the government agency's lawyer, we should be thinking about what they can do to help protect Oregon small businesses. And this bill is all about deterrence. It's not just about providing legal fees to small business. It's about deterring them from needing it in the first place. So the concept that LC came up with is a bit complicated to create a public corporation. So I wanted to let you all know that there's an amendment in the works that would simply say we're going to fund $200,000 in the Department of Justice budget whereby they could create this program and represent small businesses when needed, but more importantly, deter the services from being needed for Oregon small businesses in the first place on intellectual property. That amendment is in the works. So if the board decided to move this on to Ways and Means, that might be a route to go. It is to adopt the amendment, send it down to Ways and Means, and see if the Ways and Means Committee thought that this would be a good use of $200,000. Again, this is all about deterrence, about deterring potential predators of intellectual property from taking advantage of our small businesses that they might gamble wouldn't have the wherewithal to defend themselves. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator, I'm reminded of a number of requests that I have made to the Attorney General's office on behalf of constituents, and I get this reluctant reply back that says it's not our responsibility or right to represent private citizens, we're the state's attorneys, and then they'd go on to answer whatever question. How do you get over that hurdle?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, statute.
Okay. Senator Girard.
That's a good answer. I'm really trying to get my hands around the concept. Hey, you have the patent, and to me the patent is, that doesn't constitute property?
That doesn't cost what?
Constitute property, real property?
It's property, but its value really is primarily to ward people off from violating your intellectual property in the first place. Once they have violated it, it becomes very difficult. It's very expensive to prosecute. So it's helpful property, but, you know, when you're out raising money from investors, as I've done, Indo has raised $2.6 million from venture capital firms and angel investors so far. Especially in the very early stages of that capital accumulation process, you hear two things from them. Well, what are you going to do when the big guys come squash you, right? And you also hear, well, you know, it's nice you have a patent, but what? You know, what are you going to do with it if someone actually violates your patent? Once you're an established company, you have revenues, you're profitable, you can fund, you have a much more credible, you know, prospect for actually prosecuting a violation. But in the early days, it's property, but it isn't valued. And that's one of the problems that we're dealing with here.
I mean, it's common legend, I will say, that often a lot of established companies will use the threat of lawsuits, patent infringement or something like that, to squash new companies. So I assume that's kind of what you're getting after.
It's in that area. I mean, I think it's one of the things, you know, the final legislation has to be crafted carefully to make sure there's not, misuse of this law. But really the intention, I think, is for enterprises that are in business, that are, you know, really ramping up their activities, and that are in the early stages and don't have the wherewithal to protect themselves. Mm-hmm. So there could be all kinds of, I think, gateways in terms of how big of a company you can be, and, you know, definitely an Oregon-based company. But kind of putting in the parameters like that, I think, would help make sure that it was used properly.
It's an interesting concept. Go ahead.
Have any states done this?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
This is where I jump in and say, Oregon would really be a trailblazer, Senator.
Yeah, we're trailblazing on a lot of statistics I'm not real happy about, but okay.
I had a number of firsts, and we had some
but
firsts,
I don't need to go
firsts that we didn't that wish we hadn't. And you say you have some amendments in the works?
Yes, there's an amendment in LC. We would get that to you as soon as we
have
it.
Have you talked with the Attorney General's office at all about this?
Sam, you want
to? We did, and it was actually shortly prior to Indo's own, incident with a IP violator. And, you know, they wanted us – I mean, the question is how big of a scale of a problem is it? And I didn't have any statistics to answer a question at that moment. But I know that it's a very common problem for startups to not get their intellectual property assets actually valued in the capital accumulation stage. And I know it's extremely expensive to prosecute these kind of lawsuits. Those things are absolutely certain.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I left a message for Aaron Knott today to tell him about this new amendment idea, so I will be sure to circle back to them before we ask you to move anything.
Okay. Senator Ryder?
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, has you talked about the amendment, and during your discussion, the latter part, you talked about scaling it to make sure that it only helps actual startup companies. Has that been put into the amendment that we're looking at?
Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, I'm not sure. Let me dive into that, and I'll get back to you.
Okay.
Senator,
do you have
any
more?
Are you done?
I'm done. Thank you.
Senator Girard?
One more question. Have you thought about biological patents? Are they included or not?
Sam?
Actually, I'm not sure about the nuances around biological patents versus other types of intellectual property, no.
The reason I say that is, down the road, we have OHSU going in, and I think biological patents, but that would probably
meet the threshold that the good senator at the end was talking about. They have probably plenty of money to defend their patent, but it's an interesting concept. We'll just the cost of it and how it would actually bona fidely work is kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, when I first met with Sam, I said, this is kind of a revolutionary idea, and just keep in mind, revolutionary ideas usually take about 6 years to implement. So we're on number four, I think, at this point. Okay. We'll try to build up more support as we go.
All righty. Anything else? Thank you both.
Thank you very much.
Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 17? Okay, so we will wait to see what the amendments look like. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 17, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 32. Interesting.
Mr.
James.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 32 directs Public Utility Commission to form work group to study methods by which natural gas public utility may expand service to areas that do not currently have access to natural gas. Requires commission to report study results to interim committee of legislative assembly related to energy by September 15, 2016. Sunsets on January 2, 2017, declares emergency effective on passage. There is no revenue impact and there's no fiscal impact and there are no amendments.
Okay. Mr. Bauer, would you like to start off?
Thank you, Chair Bauer, members of the committee. Gary Bauer with Northwest Natural. I was thinking of trying to steal Senator Drodd's comment about a simple, easy bill, but with a little bit of opposition. Northwest Natural and other gas utilities routinely are asked by communities and by Business Oregon about the possibility of providing natural gas service to communities that currently do not have natural gas or expanding just within the areas where we currently serve but out to additional sites. For a number of years, we've had entities like the City of Estacada, which have approached us asking us to provide service. Recently, Reedsport had an opportunity for someone that wanted to come and reopen the mill down there, but they wanted natural gas. We have the Clackamas County Commission that has an interest in it. They want to come in and talk to us. There are communities in the Gorge. There's communities in Eastern Oregon that are looking for natural gas. And so this is really kind of an opportunity to step back and look at, see whether there are ways to serve them. Sorry.
Did you hit everybody's district? I didn't hear our chairman's district. Did anybody hit his district?
Thanks a lot, Senator.
We could probably find folks down there, too.
Okay.
Thank you, Senator.
We basically have it.
The requests oftentimes are centered around economic development purposes, supporting jobs and tax revenue for communities and schools. They can be in support of community functions such as finding ways to take the waste gas off of wastewater treatment plants, put them in a pipeline, and provide service. They could be around fueling capabilities for alternative fuel vehicles. They could be to meet air quality standards, where there are communities that are currently having issues around that, particularly those where there are wood stoves. There's other opportunities, just people want to have residents get lower cost energy options, provide choices for consumers so that they can pick and choose between their energy providers. And lastly, for some, natural gas is not subject to outages due to storms and things. The cost to extend service to a community depends on a number of factors, not the least of which is the distance from existing infrastructure. It can be the construction conditions. I'll use Estacada as an example. There's a lot of rock along that process, and so how do you get through the rock? How do you get there? It can be the road right-of-ways. It can be conditions of roads and other things. Many states have directed their natural gas utilities to look at ways of building out networks. We've looked at some of those, and they use different types of techniques for ways to fund those. Some of those of which we thought would be good for a discussion amongst parties with the Public Utility Commission. Again, we recognize that conditions can vary, so the idea was to set up a work group with the Public Utility Commission, allow parties to come forward, talk about ideas, and look at ways of addressing those. I'll note, of course, one of the things we're identifying there is potential for rate impacts to the extent that a solution might be around costs and how you allocate those costs. On that note, I know that we have groups represented of our customers, both industrial and residential customers, that that do have concerns about rate impacts, and so they will undoubtedly want to participate. The bill does list some participants. It's pretty short on that list. The PUC work groups are open to the public, and I've never been to one yet that isn't open to allow anybody to participate. And along those lines, I'll mention that the League of Oregon Cities is generally supportive of the bill. They'd like to have one of their members serve on the work group. Their comment, unless they're in the room, but they sent me a note and said they weren't going to make it, so I'm going to comment on their behalf, that they believe it would be a worthwhile discussion and may provide for enhanced opportunities for cities. And again, while I believe the PUC process is open and inclusive, the bill could be amended to either just say in addition to or not limited to, or you could add groups to the work group. Again, I understand there's some opposition from some of the other energy suppliers in the room. I guess I'd just say I'd hate to see some of our rural communities left behind in opportunities for economic development and jobs. Thank you.
Question, Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that there are cities like Estacada and some other entities that have asked you to supply natural gas, and I assume you looked into ways to do that and how it might work. And I don't know quite why we need this group I'm sure you study these things on your own, and if it can be done, you do it.
Chair Beyer, Senator Riley, yes, for example, we have looked at Estacada, and it is expensive to extend service there. Let me back up. As a regulated utility, basically kind of any of the different or types of options that we would come up with, we would have to go back and run through the Public Utility Commission. For example, there are some states that use revenues that are collected and maybe need to be refunded to customers for some type of a purpose. Those are put into a fund for for service. There are others who states that set up more like a universal service fund. So there's a fund that's kind of set and builds and grows for serving communities, and then there's a process for determining how you allocate those funds and which communities you go to. Any of those processes we believe would require involvement by the Public Utility Commission. I'm sure there are other ways, and ones we just thought that we should give everybody an opportunity to come to the table and try to figure out if there's other ways to do it. We might be able to do it through some satellite operations as well. But again, any of those require something new and different. And again, new and different things generally require us to go back to the Public Utility Commission.
Gary, those kinds of options you just discussed, I think, would probably require legislation, wouldn't they?
Chair Beyer, some very well could, yes.
I don't think the commission has authority to do that.
Senator Beyer, so again, the idea was not to come in immediately with a solution, but actually have a process that allows all the parties to come together and identify some, and maybe folks have some other opportunities or possibilities.
That's fine. I'm through. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, Gary.
Thank you.
A couple of consumer groups. Maybe I'll bring you up together. Mr. Finkley and Jeff Bissonnette. Welcome.
Thank you. Senator Beyer, members of the committee, I am Ed Finkley. I'm the executive director of the Northwest Industrial Gas Users. My members are in existing industries that use natural gas in their industrial processes. We think that the issues that are being raised by this can be addressed under current law, and thus we don't know that what's being proposed is actually necessary, but we're not categorically opposed to studying it more. The issue with line extensions is always a question of, can you do this without asking existing customers to subsidize the service to new customers? Mm-hmm. all existing natural gas customers paid to be connected to the distribution system at one time, whether it's an individual customer or a whole community. At some point, costs were incurred to connect that that community or that customer. In the past, we've been able to work this out through what are called line extension policies of the commission, which Senator Beyer, you're very familiar with. We have been in discussions recently, both in this state and in the state of Washington, with how to adjust line extension policies to be more reflective of current conditions. One of the issues that always comes up is over how many years do you expect that someone is going to use the natural gas? So if a community is saying we'd like gas extended here, well, if you assume that the system has to be paid for in 5 years, that only gives you a certain pot of dollars you can work with. If you assume 20 years, you obviously could make a much more substantial investment. So those kinds of issues we think could be discussed. At the individual level, we've noted that with the recent drop in natural gas prices, the actual line extension allowance that's allowed to a customer has actually gone down because it's generally a multiple of the revenue that's expected from service. With gas prices being lower than they were 5-6 years ago, allowances have actually gone down, which may not make much sense. So that's something else that could be explored. If a committee like or work group was going to be convened, our organization would certainly like to be part of that. We do work with existing industries who are price sensitive. We know that there are a lot of pressures on gas distribution companies for safety reasons that could require rates to go up in the future. So we're a little sensitive to keeping rates as low as possible. We know safety has to come first on the existing system. So that's a concern of ours as well. But we would certainly want to be part of the discussion if a work group or something like that were to be formed. We think these are challenging issues. As existing users of gas, we know that there are tremendous advantages with using gas, both from an economic and an environmental standpoint. We welcome the idea that others would want to connect to the gas system, but we just want to see to it that it's done without asking existing customers to subsidize services to new customers that weren't provided when they became customers.
Thank you. It's an interesting thing. It's hard to get mentally this in when you're talking about it extending the line to a customer, like an industrial plant. The line extension policy works really well, I think. When you're talking about instituting a new pipeline, or it's a little different. I'm thinking of when we the complexion not exactly the same when we did the in companion with Coos County, when we extended down to Coos County. Of course, the legislature was involved in funding part of that. That was a little different. Or when you talk about an expansion like bringing the Ruby over or something like that, it's I have to think through that a little bit. I think it's interesting. It's a different discussion than we actually ever had while I was on the commission.
Well, Coos Bay is the closest thing that I can think of. I've been in the business 30 years, and it's the closest thing I can think of where a whole community became part of the gas system, where before it had only been on propane. A line extension to an individual customer is more in line with existing commission policy, and the commission, I believe, has the authority under current law to expand its line extension policy if the issue is confined to individual customers. If you get to a whole community, that does become more of a challenge. You would still be dealing with how many years do you assume this investment will take to pay for itself? And the longer, of course, you think the investment will be used, the more money you can spend to connect that community. And often with a lot of the communities in our region, it was an industry that was sort of the anchor tenant, so to speak, for the investment. So if a community got a large industrial user, then that might put it over the top to getting an extensive distribution network in that community. Okay.
Mr. Brisson, is there any other questions from Ed? Thank you, Mr. Bissonnette.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bissonnette, representing the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon, representing residential ratepayers. And I'll just confine my remarks to the sort of text of the bill. We're neutral on the bill. We think it's a fine discussion to have, fine to have a work group. Our only concern is something Mr. Finkley noted, is just the definition of the work group seemed to us to be a little bit narrow. And as we read, you know, the bill said at a minimum the work group shall study and listed several things, but again, that at a minimum, they could go into other things. But the language around the work group is the commission shall include in the work group and named, you know, representatives of natural gas companies and a member of the House, member of the Senate, all of which are fine. But as Gary Bauer said, the process at the PUC is very open, very inclusive, and we just wanted to make sure that this bill wasn't even unintentionally sort of narrowing that inclusiveness. So some language just saying, you know, shall include but not be limited to would probably be enough to.
So you want it broader rather than.
Yeah, we just want to make sure that, as Mr. Finkley said, that, you know, customers are an active part of the discussion, as, again, that's always the expectation at the PUC. We just want to make sure that this bill isn't changing that.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. Don't see any more questions, so thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
I'm going to get this wrong. From City of Estacada, is it Tara?
Yes, that's correct. Tara Wilcoxon.
Good afternoon, Welcome. Chair Senator Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Tara Wilcoxon. I'm here in my capacity as the Economic Development Manager for the City of Estacada. I'm here to support Senate Bill 32, and I suppose today I'm the face of small rural communities that care deeply about job creation. Estacada, Oregon is located on the edge of the Mount Hood National Forest and has just shy of 3,000 people. About 7 years ago, Estacada's lumber mill closed, and since 2008, the city's annual median household income declined by 12%. Recognizing that the quality of life was slipping, the city's leadership made economic development its highest priority and held our first meeting with Northwest Natural February of 2014. We did this because not having natural gas service hinders our targeted business recruitment efforts, and it prevents Estacada's existing businesses from growing. We have a strong cluster of metal fabrication companies who can't have all of their operations located within the city of Estacada. Over the past 5 years, Estacada expanded its urban growth boundary, expanded its city limits, and have worked across state agencies with private property owners to certify 107 acres of land through Business Oregon's Industrial Site Certification Program. We are extremely thankful for that program. The land is now certified as 180-day construction-ready guarantee. And is also considered by Clackamas County to be a strategically significant employment land. Estacada has an additional 41 acres that is not certified but is available for industrial development. After much planning and hard work, we are poised to grow. It is projected that Estacada's industrial land can yield 846 direct ongoing jobs, which for a small community like ours means a 70% increase in employment for the community. How have I seen not having natural gas inhibit job creation? Estacada's industrial land is certified for both food processing and general manufacturing. But companies tell us that they require natural gas for processes such as powder coating metal products. Therefore, not having natural gas rules out Leeds that would be a good fit for Estacada's workforce and its infrastructure. This is development we have responsibly planned for. The cost of connecting to the closest main line is estimated at approximately $13 million. I believe that forming a Public Utility Commission work group to study the methods for expanding service to stranded communities is the first step towards serving Estacada and similar cities, thus is a step toward job creation for rural communities across the state. This is an open and transparent way to discuss the issue. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? It sounds like your primary interest is in natural gas for industrial uses.
That is correct.
Okay, thank you very much. And let's see, Mr. Wesby and Kemp, if you don't mind coming up together. I see you're both from propane companies. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. New glasses.
Whoever wants to go first.
Senator Beyer?
He's got the tie on.
Yes. Senator Beyer, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Joe Wesby. I'm here today on behalf of the Pacific Propane Gas Association. I am also with Ferrogas Propane. We're a propane retailer throughout the state of Oregon. And with me in the room today are other associates of mine from the propane industry around the state. For over 100 years, propane has been a consistent, reliable, and affordable source of energy in Oregon and the rest of our country. During that time, propane has become a primary source of heat for homes in rural areas. We're also a supplier of energy for industrial and commercial accounts, as well as agriculture. We currently serve a number of small towns throughout rural Oregon. Propane is not just in the boonies, as we've heard. We heat homes, we power businesses, we heat water, we run farms. Expansion of the natural gas system would threaten our business to a serious degree. Senate Bill 32 seriously threatens the livelihood of my company and the jobs of my employees, along with many other propane companies in the state of Oregon. Asking the state through Public Utility Commission to help a big utility in its marketing efforts is not just unfair. It's, well, it is unfair, especially to the propane business. Let me say very clearly that the propane industry is pro-natural gas. Much of the propane that my customers and the propane customers across Oregon use comes directly from the process of natural gas production. The ongoing production of natural gas means an increase in production of propane nationwide. There are terrific moves for Oregon and our nation for our collective energy security. When we talked about the natural gas expansion, Senator Riley brought it up. If it makes sense to go into Estacada, then go into Estacada. Why not make that business decision? I know that if I'm making that decision to grow my business, I have to take a look at what it'll take to get into a new community, decide whether or not it makes financial sense for me, invest in the infrastructure myself, and then make that move to service that community. We don't do it on the backs of a Senate bill. Coos Bay was another example. We had a retail office in Coos Bay. We still do. And at one time, we had probably twice as many gallons down there as we did before. The natural gas expansion made sense for that community, and the natural gas line made the investment. When they make that move based on business decisions, then that's fine. But doing it on the backs of existing customers and state help is not the way to go. Natural gas may be less expensive than propane, but the reason the utilities are asking for ratepayer subsidization of infrastructure is because the infrastructure costs are so much more expensive. You just heard a million-dollar quote just a second ago. The PPGA asked the committee to keep these costs in mind. This is much more complicated than just the price of natural gas versus the price of propane. Consumers may need to pay for hookup costs to the natural gas line. Those hookup costs can range in the thousands, if not tens of thousands of dollars. The PPGA is opposed to major investor-owned utilities getting special treatment by the government at the peril of their own businesses and potential of being able to have their current customers pay for infrastructure projects that the utility company itself should be paying for. In addition, no one will be hurt by this bill. I'm sorry, I take that back. No one will be hurt by this bill and appointed to serve on this task force. Nobody who would be hurt by this bill is appointed to this task force at the moment.
Thank you. Sir.
Chairman Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Randy Camp, and I'm here on behalf of my company, Coenergy Propane, who is a small Oregon-owned and independent propane supplier, as well as the Pacific Propane Gas Association, which I am presently the vice president of. I concur with everything that my colleague has said. One of the things that I want to highlight maybe is the fact that the propane industry has invested in the state of Oregon. We now service the entire state, not just portions of it. And in doing so, we are in for the long haul on what happens here in this state. An example of what my colleague mentioned about infrastructure and paying for it ourselves if we deem that that's the necessary thing. Some of you are aware of the push for alternative fuels in the state of Oregon, propane being one of those, natural gas also being one of those. An example of what we're talking about, presently the infrastructure for refueling propane-powered vehicles covers the entire state. You can go anywhere in the state of Oregon and get your propane-powered vehicle refueled. The propane industry has done that. That's not necessarily true of other alternative fuels. Their infrastructure is not out there, and we don't think that it's proper for the Oregon state government or the ratepayers that are presently paying for natural gas to foot that bill. If Joe mentioned, if the ROI is there for the natural gas company to go into a community, believe me, they would be there now. Just an example, past history, we had a general contractor start building subdivisions outside the gas lines. I think they started wanting natural gas there when we hit about 20 homes. When we got to 100 homes, they didn't have to ask anymore. They came, because they could justify it at that point. I don't know exactly the number of homes it was, but it was over 100 homes, and they could justify it, and the natural gas lines came. I think that's the way it should be. I know if I decide that I want to expand my business into an area where I presently don't cover, you know, it's my responsibility to figure out how to handle that cost and not go out and ask the government to help subsidize me and help me get that handled. But in closing, you know, as a small business owner, as well as a vice president of the Pacific Propane Gas Association, you know, I do oppose this bill and hope that you will as well.
Thank you. Questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Michael, I see you out there from the PUC. I have a question for you. My question is, I'm looking at the fiscal impact statement that says no fiscal impact.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, we feel we can do this with our existing resources, and that's why we didn't put a fiscal impact. The PUC staff is always involved in work groups, whether it be IRP, settlement conferences. We have the staff. We would use existing staff. So there's no fiscal impact on the PUC itself.
So just helping them organize a meeting where they could talk. Okay.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, yes.
All righty. Thank you, Michael. Any questions to the PUC? Seeing none. Is there anybody else who wishes to speak on Senate Bill 32? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 32. Do we have any introductions today?
No.
We do not have any. Anything else for the business for today? So we are adjourned. Thank you all. Thank you all. So we are adjourned.